Indians? What if they set up their own communities, took local jobs, imported brides, spoke their own language for generations, refusing to speak the language of the host nation, and on top of that, supported religious extremism in their country of origin? Envy is another of Mara's arrows. It is one of the great loser emotions. It manifests irrationally and generates fantastic stories to distract you. It can strike suddenly at the most unexpected times, perhaps even while you are enjoying yourself with the symphony. Even though you have no intention of becoming a cellist, you have never even touched a cello, you may become jealous of an innocent cello player whom you've never even met. Just the fact that she is talented is enough to poison your mind. Much of the world is jealous of the United States. Many of the religious and political fanatics who ridicule and criticize the U.S., calling Americans Satanists and imperialists, would fall head over heels for a green card if they don't already have one. Out of sheer envy, society, often led by the media, almost always topples anyone or anything experiencing success, whether financial, physical, or intellectual. Some journalists purport to defend the underdog and the little people, but often they are afraid to point out that some underdogs are really fanatics. These journalists refuse to expose any wrongdoing, and the few who do speak out run the risk of being stigmatized as extremists. Out of Mara's selfish desire for more disciples, he cleverly preaches freedom. But if someone really exercises freedom, Mara won't necessarily like it. Fundamentally, we like to have freedom only for ourselves, but not for others. It is no wonder that if we or anyone else really do exercise all our freedoms, we will not be invited to all the parties. This so-called freedom and democracy is just another tool of control by Mara. What about love? One might think that not all emotions are suffering. What about love, joy, creative inspiration, devotion, ecstasy, peace, union, fulfillment, relief? We believe that emotion is necessary for poetry, songs, and art. Our definition of suffering isn't fixed, and it is limited. Siddhartha's definition of suffering is much more vast, and yet much more specific and clear. Some kinds of suffering, such as aggression, jealousy, and headaches, have an obvious negative quality, while others are more subtly painful. For Siddhartha, anything that has a quality of uncertainty and unpredictability is suffering. For instance, love may be pleasant and fulfilling, but it doesn't spring independently out of the blue. It depends on someone or something, and therefore it is unpredictable. At the very least, one is dependent on the object of love, and, in a sense, always on a leash. And the additional hidden conditions are uncountable. For this reason, it is also futile to blame our parents for our unhappy childhood, or to blame ourselves for our parents' disharmony, because we are not aware of the many hidden dependent conditions involved in these situations. Tibetans use the words rangwang and shenwang to represent happiness and unhappiness. They are difficult to translate precisely. Rang means self, and wang means power, rights, or entitlement, while shen means other. Broadly speaking, as long as one is in control, one is happy. And as long as someone else holds the leash, one is unhappy. Therefore, the definition of happiness is when one has full control, freedom, rights, leisure, no obstacles, no leash. That means the freedom to choose and the freedom not to choose, the freedom to be active or to be leisurely. There are certain things we can do to bend conditions to our advantage, such as taking vitamins to become strong or drinking a cup of coffee to wake up. But we can't hold the world still so that it won't stir up another tsunami. We can't prevent a pigeon from hitting the windshield of our car. We can't control the other drivers on the freeway. A big part of our life revolves around trying to make other people cheerful, primarily so that we can feel comfortable. It's not nice living with someone who sulks all the time. But we can't keep another person's emotions upbeat at all times. We can try, and maybe we'll even succeed sometimes, but such manipulation requires a great amount of maintenance. It's not enough to say, "I love you," just once in the beginning of a relationship. You have to do the right thing. Send flowers, pay attention, until the end. If you fail even once, everything you have built can fall apart. And sometimes, even if you give undivided attention, the object of your attention may misinterpret, not know how to accept, or not be receptive at all. A young man anticipates a candlelight dinner with the girl of his dreams, imagining how the night will unfold, how he will woo and charm her. But that's just his imagination, a guess. Whether it is an educated or an uneducated guess, it's still just a guess. Basically, we can't be 100% prepared all the time. Therefore, our obstacles and opponents need to be successful only 1% of the time to do all their damage. A slip of the tongue, accidental expulsion of gas, one casual glance away from the X-ray machine at the airport security checkpoint. We might think that we aren't really suffering, and even if we are, it isn't so terrible. After all, we aren't living in the gutter or being massacred in Rwanda. Many people think, "I am okay. I'm breathing, I'm having breakfast, everything is going as well as can be expected, I am not suffering." But what do they mean? Do they mean this 100%? Have they stopped preparing for things to get better? Have they dropped all their insecurities? If such an attitude comes from genuine contentment and appreciation for what they already have, this kind of appreciation is what Siddhartha recommended, but rarely do we ever witness such content. There is always this constant nagging feeling that there's more to life, and this discontent leads to suffering. Siddhartha's solution was to develop awareness of the emotions. If you can be aware of emotions as they arise, even a little bit, you restrict their activity. They become like teenagers with a chaperone. Someone is watching, and the power of Mara is weakened. Siddhartha was not injured by the poison arrows because of his awareness that they were merely illusions. In the same way, our own powerful emotions can become as harmless as flower petals. And when the apsaras approached Siddhartha, he could see clearly that they were just assembled phenomena, like a fire ring, and therefore they lost their allure. They couldn't get a rise out of him. Similarly, we break the spell of temptation by seeing that the objects of our desire are actually just assembled phenomena. When you begin to notice the damage that emotions can do, awareness develops. When you have awareness, for example, if you know that you are on the edge of a cliff, you understand the dangers before you. You can still go ahead and do as you were doing. Walking on a cliff with awareness is not so frightening anymore. In fact, it's thrilling. The real source of fear is not knowing. Awareness doesn't prevent you from living. It makes living that much fuller. If you are enjoying a cup of tea and you understand the bitter and the sweet of temporary things, you will really enjoy the cup of tea. Chapter 3. Everything is emptiness. Soon after Siddhartha's enlightenment, his words, which we call the Dharma, began to permeate all walks of Indian life. The Dharma transcended the caste system and appealed to rich and poor alike. One of the greatest emperors of the 3rd century BCE was King Ashoka, a ruthless warrior and tyrant who had no qualms about murdering his close relatives to consolidate his power. But even King Ashoka eventually found the truth of the Dharma and became a pacifist. He is now known as one of Buddhism's most influential historical patrons. Thanks to patrons like Ashoka, the Dharma continued to thrive, traveling in every direction, pulsing far beyond the borders of India. In the first millennium CE, over 600 miles from Bodh Gaya, in the Tibetan village of Kya Ngatsa, another ordinary human with extraordinary potential was born. After a hellish childhood and an apprenticeship in black magic, this troubled young man murdered dozens of his family members and neighbors in an act of vengeance. He fled from his home and eventually met a farmer named Marpa, a great Dharma teacher and translator who taught the nature of existence and the way of life as it had once been taught by Siddhartha. The young man was transformed. He became known as Milarepa, one of the most renowned yogi saints of Tibet. Even today, his songs and stories inspire hundreds of thousands of people. The legacy of his wisdom has been passed down in an unbroken succession of teachers and students. Milarepa taught his own students that Siddhartha's words are not like other philosophies that we read for pleasure or stimulation and then put on the shelf. We can actually practice the Dharma and apply it to our day-to-day life. Among the first generation of Milarepa's students was a brilliant scholar named Rechungpa. Even though Milarepa advised him that integrating practice is more important than mere textbook study, Rechungpa set out for India anyway, intent on receiving classical instruction at one of the great Buddhist philosophical institutions existing at that time. Indeed, Rechungpa studied diligently with many great Indian scholars and saints. When he returned to Tibet after many years, his old master Milarepa came to welcome him on a barren plateau. After they'd exchanged greetings and discussed Rechungpa's studies for some time, a violent hailstorm suddenly broke from out of the sky. There was nowhere to hide in the flat open plain. Milarepa spotted a yak horn on the ground and quickly took refuge inside of it, without the horn becoming larger or Milarepa becoming smaller. From his dry shelter, Milarepa sang a song, letting Rechungpa know that there was still plenty of space in the yak horn, if only his student had realized the nature of emptiness. You might think that the story of Milarepa's yak horn is merely a fairy tale. Or, if you're the credulous type, you might believe that it was a case of sorcery performed by the Tibetan yogi. But it is neither, as we will hear. Grasping at emptiness. By conquering Mara and his army, Siddhartha realized the emptiness of inherent existence. He understood that everything we see, hear, feel, imagine, and know to exist is simply emptiness onto which we have imputed or labeled a certain trueness. This activity of labeling or perceiving the world as true is born out of a strong individual and collective habit. We all do it. The forces of habit are so strong, and our concept of emptiness is so unappealing, that few have the will to pursue a realization like Siddhartha's. Instead, we wander around like a disoriented desert traveler who sees a lush oasis in the distance. The oasis is actually just the reflection of heat on sand, yet out of desperation, thirst, and hope, the wanderer identifies it as water. Using his last strength to get there, he discovers it is only a mirage and becomes filled with disappointment. Even though we don't consider ourselves to be so desperate and believe that we are well-educated, sane, and sober, when we see and feel that everything truly exists, we are behaving like the man in the desert. We rush to find authentic companionship, security, recognition, and success, or simply peace and quiet. We may even succeed in grasping some semblance of our desires. But just like the wanderer, when we depend on external substantiation, eventually we are disappointed. Things are not as they seem, and they are not entirely within our control. If we really analyze, as Siddhartha did, we will find that labels such as form, time, space, direction, and size are easily dismantled. Siddhartha realized that even the self exists only on a relative level, just like a mirage. His realization brought an end to his cycle of expectation, disappointment, and suffering. At the moment of his liberation, he thought, "I have found a path that is profound, peaceful, non-extreme, clear, wish-fulfilling, and nectar-like. But if I attempt to express it, if I try to teach, there is no one capable of hearing, listening, or understanding. Therefore, I shall remain in this peaceful state in the forest." It is believed that upon hearing Siddhartha's plans, Lord Indra and Lord Brahma appeared and requested him not to sequester himself in the forest, but to teach for the sake of others. "Even though not everyone will understand all of your teachings," they said, "there are a few who might understand, and to help even those few would be worthwhile." Respecting their wishes, Siddhartha set out for Varanasi, which even in those days was a great city where intellectuals and thinkers gathered by the river Ganges. When Siddhartha reached Sarnath, which is near Varanasi, he came upon his former colleagues, those who had deserted him long ago when he broke his vows and drank the milk that Sujata offered. When they saw Siddhartha approaching, they quickly conspired to ignore him. They would not greet him, let alone stand up and prostrate to him. "Here comes that phony," they sneered. But for a being who has understood emptiness, as Siddhartha had, notions such as praise and criticism, veneration and contempt, good and bad, are utterly inconsequential. They are all a matter of flimsy interpretation, and thus there's no need to react as if they are solid. Therefore, Siddhartha approached without a trace of vanity, hesitation, or pride. Because of this lack of self-consciousness, his gait was so majestic that the five meditators had no choice but to stand. Siddhartha delivered his first sermon then and there, with his former colleagues as his first students. Our limited logic. Siddhartha was right to think that teaching would be no easy task. In a world that is driven by greed, pride, and materialism, even teaching basic principles such as love, compassion, and philanthropy is very difficult, let alone the ultimate truth of emptiness. We are stuck with our short-term thinking and bound by practicality. For us, something must be tangible and immediately useful in order to be worth our investment of time and energy. By those criteria, emptiness, as defined by Buddha, seems completely useless. We might think, what's the benefit of contemplating the impermanence and emptiness of the phenomenal world? How can emptiness be profitable? With our limited rationale, we have a set definition of what makes sense and what is meaningful, and emptiness goes beyond that limit. It is as if the idea of emptiness cannot fit inside our heads. This is because the human mind operates on one inadequate system of logic, even though there are countless other systems of logic available to us. We operate as if thousands of years of history have preceded this moment, and if someone were to tell us that the entirety of human evolution took place in the duration of a sip of coffee going down the throat, we would not be able to comprehend. Similarly, when we read in Buddhist teachings that one day in hell is equal to 500 years, we think that these religious figures are just trying to frighten us into submission. But imagine a week's holiday with your best beloved. It goes like the snap of the fingers. On the other hand, one night in prison with a rowdy rapist seems to last forever. Perceived in this way, our concept of time might start to seem not so stable. Some of us may permit a little bit of the unknown into our system of thinking, allowing some space for the possibilities of clairvoyance, intuition, ghosts, soulmates, and so on. But for the most part, we rely on black and white, scientifically based logic. A small handful of so-called gifted people might have the courage or the skill to go beyond convention, and as long as their view isn't too outrageous, they might be able to pass themselves off as artists, such as Salvador Dali. There are also a few celebrated yogis who deliberately go just a little bit beyond what's conventionally accepted and are venerated as divine madmen. But if you really go too far beyond the accepted boundary, if you completely buy into emptiness, people may well think that you are abnormal, crazy, and irrational. But Siddhartha was not irrational. He was merely asserting that conventional rational thinking is limited. We cannot, or will not, comprehend that which is beyond our own comfort zone. It is much more functional to work with the linear concept of yesterday, today, and tomorrow than to say time is relative. We are not programmed to think, I can fit into that yak horn without changing my size or shape. We cannot break our concepts of small and big. Instead, we continuously confine ourselves with our safe and narrow perspectives that have been handed down for generations. When these perspectives are examined, however, they don't hold up. For example, the concept of linear time upon which this world relies so heavily does not account for the fact that time has no real beginning and no end. Using this rationale, which is imprecise at best, we measure or label things as truly existing. Function, continuity, and consensus play a major part in our process of validation. We think that if something has a function, for example, your hand seems to function when holding an object, then it must exist in a permanent, ultimate, valid sense. A picture of a hand doesn't function in the same way, so we know it isn't really a hand. Similarly, if something seems to have a continuous quality, for example, if we saw a mountain yesterday and it is there today, we feel confident that it's real and it will be there tomorrow and the next day. And when other people confirm that they see the same things we see, we are even more certain that these things are truly existing. Of course, we don't walk around consciously rationalizing, confirming, and labeling the true existence of things. This is a truly existing object in my truly existing hands. But subconsciously, we operate in the confidence that the world solidly exists, and this affects how we think and feel every moment of the day. Only on rare occasions, when we look in the mirror or at a mirage, do we appreciate that some things are mere appearances. There is no flesh and blood in the mirror. There is no water in the mirage. We know that these mirror images are not real, that they are empty of inherently existing nature. This kind of understanding can take us much further, but we only go as far as our rational mind allows. When presented with the concept of a man fitting inside of a yak's horn without a change in size, we have a few choices. We can be rational and refute the story by saying that it's simply not possible. Or we can apply some kind of mystic belief in sorcery or blind devotion and say, oh yes, Milarepa was such a great yogi, of course he could do this and even more. Either way, our view is distorted. Because denying is a form of underestimating, and blind faith is a form of overestimating. Yesterday's river. Accepting partial logic. Through his tireless contemplation, Siddhartha clearly saw the faults in these conventional forms of estimating, rationalizing, and labeling. Of course they work to an extent. Our world seems to function based on these conventions. When we human beings talk about something genuinely and truly existing, we talk about it being definite, not imagined, real, provable, unchanging, and unconditional. Of course, we say that some things change. A bud blooms into a flower, and we still think of it as a truly existing flower as it changes. That growth and change is part of our fixed idea about the nature of the flower. We would be much more surprised if it became permanent. So, in that sense, our expectation of change is unchanging. A river flows with fresh water, always changing, and we still call it a river. If we visit that place a year later, we think it's the same river. But how is it the same? If we isolate one aspect or characteristic, the sameness falls apart. The water is different. The earth is in a different place in its rotation through the galaxy. The leaves have fallen and been replaced. All that remains is an appearance of a river similar to the one that we saw last time. Appearance is quite an unstable basis for truth. Through simple analysis, the underpinnings of our conventional reality are revealed to be vague generalizations and assumptions. Although Siddhartha used words similar to the ones ordinary people might when defining truth, not imagined, definite, unchanging, unconditional, his use of these words is much more precise. They are not generalizations. In his view, unchanging must mean unchanging in all dimensions, without exception, even after thorough analysis. Our ordinary definition of truth is a result of partial analysis. If analysis leads to a comfortable answer, if it gives us what we want, we don't go beyond that. Is this really a sandwich? It tastes like a sandwich, so I'll eat it. Analysis stops there. A boy is looking for a companion. He sees a girl. She looks beautiful, so he stops analyzing and approaches. Siddhartha's analysis kept going further and further until the sandwich and the girl were just atoms, and finally even the atoms could not hold up to his analysis. Finding nothing there, he was free from disappointment. Siddhartha found that the only way to confirm something as truly existing is to prove that it exists independently and free of interpretation, fabrication, or change. For Siddhartha, all of the seemingly functional mechanisms of our everyday survival, physical, emotional, and conceptual, fall outside of that definition. They are all put together from unstable, impermanent parts, and therefore they are always changing. We can understand this assertion in the conventional world. For example, you could say that your reflection in the mirror does not truly exist because it depends on your standing in front of it. If it were independent, then even without your face there should be a reflection. Similarly, no thing can truly exist without depending on so many uncountable conditions. We look at a fire ring and we have no problem understanding the conditions of its fabrication. We accept that as long as these parts are all working together, it really is a fire ring, for now. But why can't we think that way about the telephone we are holding or the bed we're lying on as we listen? It looks like a phone. Other people see it as a phone. It functions like a phone, but when you analyze it, the for now principle can be applied to it as well. Everything we perceive during our lives is for now. Things appear to exist for the moment. We just don't have the courage or the will to look at it this way. And because we don't have the intelligence to see things in parts, we settle for looking at them as a whole. If all the feathers are plucked from a peacock, we are no longer awed by it. But we are not eager to surrender to seeing all the world this way. It's like being curled up in a bed, having a good dream, slightly conscious that you're dreaming, and not wanting to wake up. or seeing a beautiful rainbow and not wanting to get close because it will disappear. Having the courageous spirit to wake up and examine is what Buddhists call renunciation. Contrary to popular belief, Buddhist renunciation is not self-flagellation or austerity. Siddhartha was willing and able to see that all of our existence is merely labels placed on phenomena that do not truly exist, and through that, he experienced awakening. Buddha was not a masochist. Many people who have only a vague idea of what Buddha taught think that Buddhism is morbid, that Buddhists negate happiness and think only of suffering. They assume that Buddhists shun beauty and physical enjoyments because they are temptations. Buddhists are supposed to be pure and temperate. Actually, Siddhartha's teachings are not prejudiced against beauty and enjoyment any more than they're against other concepts, as long as we don't get carried away into thinking that such things really exist. Siddhartha had a lay disciple, a warrior named Manjushri, who was known as a great wit and a trickster. Among Manjushri's fellow students was a very diligent and respected monk who was well known for his ugliness meditation, a method that is prescribed, among many others, to those who are desire-oriented and have a lot of passion. It involves imagining all human beings as made of veins, cartilage, intestines, and such. Manjushri decided to test the diligent monk by using his supernatural powers. He transformed himself into a beautiful nymph and appeared before the monk to seduce him. For some time, the good monk remained uncorrupted, not moving a muscle. But Manjushri proved to be overpoweringly seductive, and the monk began to fall under his spell. He was surprised because during many years of meditation, he had successfully resisted some of the most beautiful women in the land. Shocked and disappointed in himself, the monk fled. But the nymph Manjushri chased him until the exhausted monk collapsed on the ground. As the seductive woman approached him, he thought, "That's it. This beautiful girl is about to embrace me." He shut his eyes tightly and waited, but nothing happened. When he finally opened his eyes, the nymph had been dismantled into fragments, and Manjushri appeared, laughing. "Thinking that someone is beautiful is a concept," he said. "Clinging to that concept confines you, ties you in a knot, and imprisons you. But if you think that someone is ugly, that is also a concept, and that will also bind you." Every year we spend huge sums of money making ourselves and our environment attractive. But what is beauty? We may say that it's in the eye of the beholder, yet millions of us tune in to the Miss Universe pageant to be told who is the most beautiful in all the universe, according to a panel of judges. These 10 or so people allegedly give us the ultimate definition of beauty. Of course, there will always be dissenters, given the fact that within this universe they are ignoring the beautiful women of Papua New Guinea and the elegant African tribal women who wear rings around their elongated necks. If Siddhartha sat in on a Miss Universe pageant, he would see another kind of ultimate beauty altogether. To his eyes, the one who is crowned cannot be the ultimate beauty because her beauty depends on the beholder. Because Siddhartha's definition of ultimate requires independence from any and all conditions. For her to be truly beautiful, there would be no need for the condition of a pageant because everyone would automatically agree that she's the ultimate. And if she is truly beautiful, there cannot be a moment of being slightly not so beautiful. She would have to be beautiful when she's yawning, when she's snoring, when saliva is dripping from her mouth, and when she's squatting on the toilet, when she's old, all the time. Instead of seeing one contestant as any more or less beautiful than the others, Siddhartha would see that all women are empty of both ugliness and beauty. The beauty he sees is in the hundreds of millions of perspectives from which any one contestant can be viewed. of the abundant points of view in the universe, someone must be jealous. Someone must see her as their lover, their daughter, sister, mother, friend, rival. To a crocodile, she's food. To a parasite, she's a host. To Siddhartha, this array is in itself astonishingly beautiful, whereas if someone is truly and ultimately beautiful, she would have to be fixed in that state of beauty forevermore. All the gowns and swimsuits, lights and lipstick would not be necessary. As it is, we have the display of the pageant, and for now, the spectacle is as beautiful as our old assembled and impermanent fire ring. Relative truth, existing somewhat. In Buddhist philosophy, anything that is perceived by the mind did not exist before the mind perceived it. It depends on the mind. It doesn't exist independently, therefore it doesn't truly exist. That is not to say that it doesn't exist somewhat. Buddhists call the perceived world relative truth, a truth that is measured and labeled by our ordinary minds. In order to qualify as ultimate truth, it must not be fabricated, it must not be a product of the imagination, and it must be independent of interpretation. Although Siddhartha realized emptiness, emptiness was not manufactured by Siddhartha or anyone else. Emptiness is not the result of his revelation, nor was it developed as a theory to help people be happy. Whether or not Siddhartha taught it, emptiness has always been emptiness. Although, paradoxically, we can't even really say that emptiness has always been, because it is beyond time and has no form. Nor should emptiness be interpreted as negation of existence. That is, we can't say that this relative world doesn't exist either, because in order to negate something, you have to acknowledge that there is something to negate in the first place. Emptiness doesn't cancel out our daily experience. Siddhartha never said that something spectacular, better, purer, or more divine exists in place of what we perceive. He wasn't an anarchist refuting the appearance or function of worldly existence either. He didn't say that there's no appearance of a rainbow or that there's no cup of tea. We can enjoy our experience, but just because we can experience something doesn't mean that it truly exists. Siddhartha simply suggested that we examine our experience and consider that it could be just a temporary illusion, like a daydream. If someone asked you to flap your arms and fly, you would say, "I can't," because in our experience of the relative world, it is not physically possible to fly any more than it's possible to hide inside a yak horn. But suppose that you are asleep and dreaming that you are flying through the sky. If someone in the dream says, "Human beings can't fly," you will say, "Yes, I can, see?" And you will fly away. Siddhartha would agree on both counts. You can't fly when you are awake, and you can fly when you are asleep. The reasons are the causes and conditions that have or have not come together. A condition necessary to be able to fly is to be dreaming. When it is not there, you can't fly. When it is, you can. If you dream that you're flying and continue to believe that you can fly even after you wake up, that becomes a problem. You will fall and you will be disappointed. Siddhartha says that even when we wake up in the relative world, we are asleep with ignorance, like the palace courtesans on the night that he fled his previous existence. When the right causes and conditions come together, anything can appear. But when those conditions are exhausted, the appearance stops. Viewing our experience in this world as a dream, Siddhartha found that our habit of fixating on the mere appearance of our own dream-like relative world, thinking that it is truly existing, throws us into an endless cycle of pain and anxiety. We are in a deep sleep, hibernating like a silkworm in a cocoon. We have woven a reality based on our projections, imagination, hopes, fears, and delusions. Our cocoons have become very solid and sophisticated. Our imaginings are so real to us that we are trapped in the cocoon. But we can free ourselves simply by realizing that this is all our imagination. There must be infinite ways to wake up from this sleep. Even substances like peyote and mescaline might give us a vague notion of the illusory aspect of reality. But a drug cannot provide total awakening, if only because this awakening is dependent on an external substance, and when the effect of the mescaline is gone, the experience is gone as well. Suppose that you're having a really bad dream. All it takes is a flicker of realization that you're dreaming to wake you up. The spark can come from within a dream. When you do something anomalous within the dream, you may be jostled into realizing that you're asleep. Peyote and mescaline can spark a short-lived realization by revealing the power of the mind and the imagination. Hallucinations help us temporarily recognize how tangible and believable illusions can be. But such substances are not advisable because they provide only an artificial experience, one that can actually harm the body. Instead, we should have the aspiration to wake up once and for all, without depending on external input. We are much better off when realization comes from within. What we really need is to wake up from our habitual patterns, imagination, and greed. Mind training and meditation are the swiftest, safest, and most effective ways to work within the mind stream. As Siddhartha said, you are your own master. It is the attachment that binds you. Siddhartha completely understood that in the relative world you can make a cup of oolong tea and drink it. He would not say, "There's no tea," or "Tea is emptiness." If he were to say anything at all, it would be to suggest that the tea is not as it seems. For example, tea is shriveled leaves and hot water. But some tea fanatics get carried away with the leaves and composing special mixes, creating names like Iron Dragon and selling small amounts for hundreds of dollars. To them, it's not just a leaf in water. It was for this reason that some 1,500 years after Siddhartha taught, one of his Dharma heirs, named Tsalopa, said to his student Naropa, "It is not the appearance that binds you, it's the attachment to the appearance that binds you." There was once a beautiful nun called Utpala. A man fell deeply in love with her and began to stalk her. His pursuit made her uncomfortable, and she tried to avoid him, but he was relentless. Finally, one day, to his complete shock, she came toward him and confronted him. Fumbling for words, he blurted out that he loved her eyes. Without hesitation, she took them out and handed them to him. His shock made him see how easily one is caught up and obsessed with assembled parts. When he overcame his shock and horror, he became her disciple. In another Japanese Buddhist fable, two traveling Zen monks were about to wade across a river when a young woman asked them to carry her over the swift water. Both of these monks had taken advanced vows and were not permitted to touch women, but without hesitation, the older monk lifted her up, put her on his back, and walked across. When they reached the other side, he let the woman down and, without any small talk, walked away. A few hours later, the younger monk blurted out, "Aren't we monks? Why did you carry that woman?" The older monk replied, "I put her down a long time ago. Why are you still carrying her?" In a moment of clarity, we may be able to see the emptiness of abstract concepts such as beauty and ugliness. They are open to interpretation, after all. but it is much more difficult for us to understand the emptiness of non-abstract things, such as the car that needs repair, the bills that must be paid, the health-threatening high blood pressure, the family that supports us or that needs our support. It's understandable that we aren't willing or able to see these things as illusory. It's much more ridiculous when we get caught up in extravagances such as high fashion, haute cuisine, celebrity status, and membership in elite clubs. More than a few people are so spoiled that having a television in every room or 200 pairs of shoes seems like a necessity. Lusting after a pair of Nikes or a Giorgio Armani suit at a posh boutique goes far beyond the practical survival impulse. People even get into fights over handbags in stores. The assembled phenomena of packaging and market research are so intricate and calculated that we become suckers for labels, accepting the ridiculous price tags that have no correlation with material value. Since the majority of people subscribe to the point of view that these things have value, it's difficult for an image-conscious Louis Vuitton lover to understand the essenceless of her obsession with her genuine leather handbag, let alone the essenceless of the bag itself. Reinforced by popular culture, the importance of bourgeois status and labels becomes more solid in our minds, making our world ever more artificial. On top of being manipulated by bill collectors and marketing geniuses, we are pushed and pulled by political systems such as democracy and communism, abstract concepts such as individual rights, and moral positions such as anti-abortion and the right to die. The political world is filled with such labels, and the chances of genuine leadership are slim to none. Human beings have experimented with various types of leadership, and each of them has its benefits, yet many people still suffer. There may be some politicians with real integrity, but in order to win an election, they must label themselves as pro-gay rights or anti-gay rights, even if they don't have strong feelings on the issue. Most often, we find ourselves unwillingly complying with what the majority thinks, even if it's an insane position, in order to get along in this so-called democratic world. A long time ago, in a drought-ridden country, a respected soothsayer predicted that after 7 days there would finally be rain. His prediction came true, and there was great rejoicing. He then predicted a rain of jewels, and once again his prediction was accurate. The people were very happy and prosperous. His next prediction was that after 7 days there would be another rain, a cursed rain, and anyone who drank this rainwater would go insane. The king ordered huge amounts of uncontaminated water to be stored so that he wouldn't have to drink the cursed rain. But his subjects didn't have the resources to store their water. When the rain came, they drank the water and became crazy. The king alone was sane, but he could not rule his crazy subjects, so as a last resort, he too drank the water. In order to rule them, he needed to share in their delusions. As in the Miss Universe contest, everything that we do or think in this world is based on a very limited system of shared logic. We put so much emphasis on consensus. If the majority agrees that something is true, then it usually becomes valid. When we look at a small pond, we humans just see a pond, but to the fish in the pond, this is their universe. If we take a democratic stance, then the aquatic dwellers should win, because there are many more of them than there are of us pond gazers. Majority rule doesn't always work. Terrible blockbuster films can gross huge profits, while a fascinating independent film is seen by only a handful of people. And because of our reliance on group thinking, the world is often ruled by the most short-sighted and corrupt rulers. Democracy appeals to the lowest common denominator. the truth. Not a fable, not magic, not deadly. It's difficult for us whose minds are conditioned by pragmatism to understand emptiness. That's why Milarepa's refuge inside the Yakhorn is almost always brushed aside as a fable. It cannot fit inside our small brain, just as the ocean cannot fit inside a well. Once there was a frog who lived in a well. One day he met a frog from the ocean. The ocean frog told fantastic tales of his ocean and boasted of its vastness. But the well frog couldn't believe him. He believed his well to be the biggest and most fabulous body of water in the world because he had no reference point, no experience, no reason to think otherwise. So the ocean frog took the well frog to the ocean. Facing the vastness of the ocean, the well frog died of a heart attack. Realization isn't necessarily lethal. We don't have to be like the well frog, dropping dead when we're exposed to emptiness. If the ocean frog had been a bit more compassionate and skillful, he might have been a better guide, and the well frog wouldn't have died. Perhaps he would have eventually migrated to the ocean. We don't need a supernatural gift to understand emptiness. It's a matter of education and a willingness to see things in terms of all their parts and hidden causes and conditions. With such insight, one becomes like a set designer or a camera assistant who goes to the cinema. Professionals see beyond what we see. They see how the camera was positioned, which lenses and lighting equipment were used, how the crowds were computer-generated, and all the other cinematic techniques that the audience isn't aware of, and thus, for them, the illusion is dismantled. Yet the professionals can still enjoy themselves immensely when they go to the cinema. This is an example of Siddhartha's transcendent humor. Neckties and the noose of emotion. The classic Buddhist example used to illustrate emptiness is the snake and the rope. Let's say there's a cowardly man named Jack who has a phobia about snakes. Jack walks into a dimly lit room, sees a snake coiled up in the corner, and panics. In fact, he's looking at a striped Giorgio Armani tie, but in his terror he has misinterpreted what he sees to the point that he can even die of fright. Death caused by a snake that does not truly exist. While he is under the impression that it's a snake, the pain and anxiety that he experiences is what Buddhists call samsara, which is a kind of mental trap. Fortunately for Jack, his friend Jill walks into the room. Jill is calm and sane and knows that Jack thinks he sees a snake. She can switch on the light and explain that there is no snake, that it is actually a tie. When Jack is convinced that he is safe, this relief is none other than what the Buddhists call nirvana, liberation and freedom. But Jack's relief is based on a fallacy of harm being averted, even though there was no snake and there was nothing to cause his suffering in the first place. It's important to understand that by switching on the light and demonstrating that there is no snake, Jill is also saying that there is no absence of the snake. In other words, she cannot say, "The snake is gone now," because the snake was never there. She didn't make the snake disappear, just as Siddhartha didn't make emptiness. This is why Siddhartha insisted that he could not sweep away the suffering of others by waving his hand. Nor could his own liberation be granted or shared piecemeal, like some sort of award. All he could do was explain from his experience that there was no suffering in the first place, which is like switching on the light for all of us. When Jill finds Jack frozen in terror, she has some choices about what to do. She can directly point out that there is no snake, or she can use a skillful method, such as escorting the snake from the room. But if Jack is so terrified that he's unable to differentiate the snake from the tie, even with the light on, and if Jill is not skillful, then she could actually make things worse. if she dangles the necktie in Jack's face, he could die of a heart attack. But if Jill is skillful and sees that Jack is delusional, she can say, "Yes, I see the snake," and carefully take the tie out of the room so that Jack feels safe for the time being. Maybe then, when he is relaxed, he can be gently guided to the point of seeing that there was never a snake in the first place. If Jack had never even gone into the room, if there was no misapprehension, then the whole scenario of seeing a snake or not seeing a snake is nullified. But because he saw a snake and is caught in the scenario, and because he is paralyzed with fear, he wants a means of escape. Siddhartha's teachings are a method for such liberation. The Dharma is sometimes referred to as a holy path, although, strictly speaking, there is no divinity in Buddhism. A path is a method or tool that leads us from one place to another. In this case, the path leads us out of ignorance to the absence of ignorance. We use the word holy or venerable because the wisdom of Dharma can release us from fear and suffering, which is generally the role of the divine. Our everyday experience of life is full of uncertainties, occasional joys, anxieties, and emotions that coil around us like a snake. Our hopes, fears, ambitions, and general hysteria create the darkness and shadows that allow the illusion of the snake to become even more vivid. Like the cowardly Jack, we hunt for solutions in all corners of the darkened room. The sole purpose of Siddhartha's teaching is to help cowards like us understand that our suffering and paranoia are all based on illusions. Even though Siddhartha could not erase suffering with the wave of a wand or some divine power, he was very skillful when it came to switching on the light. He provided many paths and methods for discovering the truth. In fact, there are tens of thousands of paths to follow within Buddhism. So, why not simplify it into one method? The reason is that, like the variety of medicines needed for different diseases, a variety of methods are necessary for different kinds of habits, cultures, and attitudes. Whichever one is followed depends on the state of mind of the student and the skill with which the teacher is adorned. Instead of shocking everyone with emptiness right from the beginning, Siddhartha taught his masses of students with popular methods such as meditation and codes of conduct. Do the right thing, don't steal, don't tell lies. He prescribed different levels of renunciation and austerity, from shaving heads to abstaining from meat, depending on the nature of the student. Seemingly religious and strict paths work well for those who cannot initially hear or comprehend emptiness, as well as for those whose nature is suited to asceticism. How Buddha taught. Dharma as placebo. Some people think that stringent rules and virtuous deeds are the essence of Buddhism, but these are only a small component of Buddha's skillful and